And of course, with a gift, it's not the money, it's the thought that counts. That thought? Let's bribe the president.
Well, actually, that's harder than you may think.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
A $400 million plan?
I got the feeling there's something right.
Not bribery.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
So we're told.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs.
By the Supreme Court.
Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Oh, my. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of the. And I got to say, you know, it's always a good day when we get to report on election results on the Bradcast. Desi Doyen, what do you think about that?
Yes, it is always good to report on elections.
Well, not always good, but at least when there's good results, and we do have some good news election results for you today, believe it or not. I'm happy to share this with you from via our friend Daniel Nashanian of boltsmag.org. He is better known on the social medias as Taniel, an excellent election result follower. He reported last night on Blue Sky, Omaha's Republican mayor, Jean Stothert, just lost to her Democratic challenger, John Ewing Jr. in Omaha, Nebraska. Stothert, if that's how you say her name, pardon me if it isn't, she was running for a fourth term in Omaha. She resorted to anti-trans ads and messaging around who uses the bathrooms and high school sports in the final stretch of the campaign, and it did not work. As it turns out, John Ewing will be Omaha's first black mayor after four terms of the Republican in office. As the New York Times notes, the unofficial victory would end a long era of Republican leadership in the closely divided city of nearly a million residents in an otherwise reliably red state. Omaha is Nebraska's largest city. Jane Klieb, the chairwoman of the Nebraska Democratic Party, said in a statement that, quote, "We made historic progress tonight, and tomorrow the hard work continues on as we look to 2026. Omaha's result comes weeks after a series of major losses in school board elections for conservatives who championed attacks on trans children, notes Nashanian. Now, we didn't get to cover these last week, these results. I can't recall why, but it came after Saturday elections in Texas just over a week ago. As Nashanian reported at the time, Texas conservatives who've championed book bans and anti-LGBT policies suffered big losses in school board races in Texas, and they seem to have lost their working majorities to pass their policies in big school boards across the state. In the Fort Bend school board election, for example, one of the largest in the entire state, so-called conservatives lost two critical school board seats that they had held. This particular board in Fort Bend had adopted one of Texas's most restrictive book banning policies on a 5-2 vote. Voters ousted a conservative incumbent, and the right-wing candidate lost to replace a retiring conservative, flipping two of those five seats away from conservatives. And, well, you wouldn't have had that. That policy would not have had a majority to pass to ban books in Fort Bend, Texas.
Good.
So the majority on that board has now been flipped. The Katy School Board, another among Texas' largest, saw a big loss for the right in the greater Houston area last week. According to Nashanian, voters ousted the board's ultra-conservative president, who had championed a policy against trans students that had passed on a 4-3 vote. Voters apparently didn't care for that. So ultra-conservative president of the school board in Katy been out, then they wouldn't have been able to pass that anti-trans bill by a 4-3 vote. So
I'm very glad to see that voters in Texas and in Nebraska are catching on to these ultra right-wing radical policies that these right-wingers are trying to pass.
They seem to be
attacking trans kids, banning books. I mean, voters are saying, this is America. We don't do that.
Well, we didn't used to do that.
Yeah, that's a better way to put it.
Both of those in Texas were in the Houston area. Over in the Dallas-Fort Worth area on the other side of the state, well, north of the state, in any case, voters in Greater Fort Worth ousted a conservative member of the Grapevine Colleyville School Board, who was part of the board's majority when they passed a policy that let teachers reject children's pronouns, even if parents approved of them. That was adopted on a 4-3 vote, and a conservative member in that majority was, yes, ousted by voters last week. And finally, as Nishanian reported for boltsmag.org, voters in Mansfield, Texas, ousted 3 conservative members of their local school board last week, a school board that has been at the front lines of book banning in Texas. All of that in deep in the heart of Texas. And Desi, as you like to say, even in your old home state, elections matter.
They certainly do.
Even for school board, even for Texas, even for mayor in red Nebraska. And right now, elections may be just about all we've got. That, and as our guest yesterday, Bobby Kogan, former Biden-Harris White House budget advisor and chief budget analyst at the U.S. Senate Budget Committee prior to that, as he said, the public also not just voting but making noise, protesting in the streets, calling your members of Congress to let them know loudly and clearly how you feel about any particular thing. Yesterday in our conversation with Kogan, it was in the context of the Republicans' plans for huge and cruel and deadly cuts to Medicaid and the SNAP food nutrition program and more. It will be the public, hopefully a well-informed public, which is where my job in all of this comes in, I guess. The public who changes the course of this disastrous road that we are still on. There are no white knights coming for us. You're it. We're it. The public, be it in the streets, on the phones, or at the ballot box. When the royal family of Qatar wants to give Donald Trump a personal gift of a $400 million Flying Palace 747, it ain't going to be the Justice Department that steps in to stop that. It is going to be you and me somehow. It is going to be reporting and shaming by the media and voters taking action on that reported corruption, ultimately at the ballot box. We'll be joined momentarily by the DOJ's former chief of the fraud and public corruption section to discuss all of the above. But it seems to me, so far anyway, that voters, yes, even in Nebraska, even in Texas, are still doing their part, at least. So take some comfort in that. As Obama used to like to say, we are the ones we've been waiting for. So hang in there, stay healthy, stay strong. We will figure out this madness yet. The courts also, for the most part, still seem to be doing their job when given the opportunity, if not always the Supreme Court, but we'll see how things go there. To that end, a couple of encouraging updates on a couple of different stories we've been covering in recent weeks before I get to my guest. We covered this story originally on Earth Day last month, as I recall, but a good news update on it. A federal judge on Tuesday ordered the reinstatement of nearly 200 fired federal workers who screened coal miners for black lung, a deadly and incurable disease caused by inhaling toxic coal dust. No, it is not clean or beautiful, Mr. Trump. A day later, After the federal judge ordered the reinstatement of the workers, they were back on the job after the Trump administration had complied with the judge's order. U.S. District Judge Irene Berger, an Obama appointee, issued a preliminary injunction on Tuesday that compels the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH, a division of the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, to bring back the workers in the Coal Workers Health Surveillance Program that we described as outrageously being shut down by the Trump administration last month, despite Trump's pretend claims that how much he loves coal, he loves his coal miners, doesn't he? Even as he was shutting down the program that helps keep those coal miners alive. Judge Berger said the Trump administration officials, quote, lack the authority to unilaterally cancel the screening program, which is mandated by the Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety Act of 1969, as we originally explained on this show last month. She ordered the program to be fully restored with, quote, no pause, stoppage, or gap in the protections and services. Under the screening program, coal miners can receive free and confidential chest x-rays to determine whether their lung tissue is damaged. Those who are diagnosed with black lung can then, by law, transfer to a less dusty part of the mine without having a pay cut, and they can apply for federal compensation for medical treatments and prescription drugs, and can get help finding a different job that won't kill them like coal mining.
In other words, the law protects them from being retaliated against for seeking screening and for treatment. So,
for being retaliated, for being punished with, if you're not willing to go do that job, we're going to pay you less money. That medical program, that critical medical program to help keep coal miners alive, that's the program that the Trump administration tried to shut down on April 1 when it fired most of the staff working on the program as part of massive layoffs at the Department of Health and Human Services under Bobby Kennedy Jr. On April 30, thanks to public pressure, the administration at least temporarily reinstated some of those fired workers, 30 to 40 of them, until June 2nd. Then, last week, Judge Berger heard testimony from two West Virginia coal miners with black lung who urged the judge to permanently restore the workers' jobs. After Berger's ruling, the fired NIOSH workers received an email late on Tuesday saying their supposed reduction in force notices had been rescinded. Scott Laney, an epidemiologist who leads research for the screening program, said that he and his colleagues were, quote, very happy with the development. Quote, we are back to work, Laney said today, the day after the ruling. We still have a lot of questions regarding normal operations, but we have been in the office today, and we certainly intend to get back in the field and start providing the services that coal miners deserve. The order, said a lawyer for one of the West Virginia coal miners with black lung who sued, quote, represents one very significant reversal of Trump's unconstitutional abandonment of Appalachia, but hopefully not the last, he said. So there's some good news.
Yes, that is very good news.
And in a bit more good news for now, follow up to another story that we covered recently on the show. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says it will restore information about climate change that was scrubbed from its website when Donald Trump took office. That, according to court documents filed this week in a lawsuit over the deletion of that critical data. The deleted data included pages on federal funding and loans, forest conservation, and rural clean energy projects. It also included sections of the U.S. Forest Service and Natural Resources Conservation Service sites and the U.S. Forest Service's Climate Risk Viewer, which included detailed maps showing how climate change might affect national forests and grasslands, which the Trump administration tried to make disappear. That is, of course, information that is valuable for farmers. Farmers who are right around now trying to figure out what to plant, when to plant it, and if to plant it at all based on our quickly changing climate. So like those coal miners that Trump claimed to love when he needed their votes before then going on to just cut off the programs that saved their lives. He also claimed to, you know, love the farmers when he needed their votes, only to come to office and cut them off from the USDA support that they have long counted on to know how to manage their farms. Why? Well, because it had something to do with climate change, which, you know, doesn't exist if you simply delete all of the data about it from the websites, apparently.
No data, no problem.
The lawsuit was filed in February, and it said that the website data purge denied farmers information to make time-sensitive decisions while facing business risks linked to, yup, climate change, like heat waves, droughts, floods, wildfires. The suit, as we initially reported on it some weeks ago, was brought by the Northeast Organic Farming Association of New York, along with the Natural Resources Defense Council and the Environmental Working Group. The plaintiffs had sought a court order requiring the department to restore the deleted pages. On Monday, the government, before even waiting for the ruling, as I understand it, said they would oblige. Okay, we'll put them back. Jay Clayton, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, wrote to Judge Margaret Garnett that he was representing the Ag Department in the lawsuit and that the department had already begun restoring the pages and interactive tools described in the lawsuit and that he, quote, expects to substantially complete the restoration process in approximately 2 weeks. Now, why it takes 2 weeks to restore the data that I think they took down over just days, that's another question. Hopefully this is not an attempt to stall for something else, but we will for now take it as good news. Jeffrey Stein, associate attorney at Earth Justice, an environmental law nonprofit that represents the plaintiffs, along with the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. Maybe that's one another reason why Trump's been attacking Columbia University. Anyway, Jeffrey Stein said, quote, "We're glad the USDA recognized that its blatantly unlawful purge of climate change related information is harming farmers and communities across the country." You know, that's information. That's data that we paid for, taxpayers paid for. And now they're just, you know, they're taking it down. You don't deserve to have the data that you paid for. Apparently, that was the idea.
Well, at least the USDA lawyer realizes that ain't going to fly.
Apparently.
For
because
now,
I'm surprised it didn't take a court order that he came in and said, okay, we'll put it back. Are they running out of people at the Justice Department to fight these cases? Maybe. In any event, the courts are holding. Pushback works. And while it's, I know, still pretty grim out there, hope must spring eternal as far as I'm concerned. There is always another election on the horizon. Yes, even in the Trump era. And that pushback is working. That's true, even in regards to some of Donald Trump's most blatant and outrageous corruption. As we have seen this week in the pushback from the public, in the media, even from some right-wing circles against his outrageously corrupt scheme to accept the personal gift of a $400 million airplane from the royal family of Qatar. The former chief of the DOJ's Fraud and Public Corruption Section at the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C., Randall Eliason, our old friend joins us next on the broadcast to discuss that and more at his old beloved Department of Justice. I'm Brad Friedman. This is the broadcast. Don't touch that dial.
Hey, this is Desi. The broadcast and the Green News Report survive thanks to you and your support. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate today to help us stay independent every day over your public airwaves. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Yeah!
Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. All right. As we explained on Monday, the day after this ridiculously, unspeakably corrupt story first came to light, just hours earlier, the royal family of Qatar's gift, or offer of a gift, of a $400 million 747 jumbo jet plane blinged out as a flying palace to Donald Trump for his use as Air Force One for the remainder of his term, to be given to his presidential library for his continued use after leaving office, is both outrageously corrupt and, more importantly, I believe, a strict violation of the U.S. Constitution's Foreign Emoluments Clause. Article 1, Section 9, Clause 8 of the Constitution reads in full, quote, "No title of nobility shall be granted by the United States, and no person holding any office or profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of the Congress, accept of any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state." Seems pretty clear. Ironically here, I guess, the Qatari royal family represents all of the above, a king, a prince, a foreign state. Quote, "Trump must seek Congress's consent to take this gift from Qatar," said constitutional law expert Jamie Raskin, congressman of Maryland, the top Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, adding, "The Constitution is perfectly clear. No present, quote, of any kind whatever, from a foreign state without congressional permission. A gift you use for 4 years and then deposit in your library is still a gift and a grift," Raskin wrote on X. Following ABC News' initial report on this, Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer described the gift as, quote, "not just bribery, it's premium foreign influence with extra leg room." Democratic Senator Adam Schiff of California said, quote, "the corruption is brazen." But wait, Donald Trump's own White House counsel's office and the Department of Justice, on behalf of Trump's Attorney General Pam Bondi, we were told, anticipated these complaints. They already looked at the issue before the story became public, and they determined in an analysis for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth that all of this is perfectly legal, that it is legal for the Department of Defense to accept the aircraft as a gift and then later turn it over to the Trump Library, and that it does not violate laws against bribery or the Constitution's prohibition, the Emoluments Clause, of any U.S. government official accepting gifts, quote, from any king, prince, or foreign state. They concluded it would be, quote, legally permissible for the donation of the aircraft to be conditioned on transferring its ownership to Trump's presidential library before the end of his term. Hard to believe that Pam Bondi or her fellow Republicans would have made the same argument had Qatar or Saudi Arabia given Barack Obama or Joe Biden a $400 million plane decked out like a palace for a Persian potentate for their own personal use after leaving office, if they had pretended that really it was just a gift to the Department of Defense and my presidential library, not me, nothing to see here. While most Republicans have suddenly fallen silent on the matter, to their credit, some have not. But to his credit, I guess, even right-wing MAGA podcaster Ben Shapiro had the guts to slam Trump on Monday for accepting a $400 million jet from Qatar, noting, quote, "taking sacks of goodies from people who support Hamas, that's not America first. I think inherently it is bad. I think if we switch the names to Hunter Biden and Joe Biden, we'd all be freaking out on the right." That was Ben Shapiro. And you bet they would. And in this case, it seems to me, at least, they would be right to do so in such a case. Of course, I can't imagine a Democrat actually doing such a thing, which is why Republicans generally have to make up absurd cases of corruption, like the idea that the Biden family was receiving tens of millions of dollars secretly from Ukraine and from China, despite evidence, all evidence to the contrary. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, called the move, quote, "corrupt and unconstitutional." He said, "I don't know who needs to hear this." This in apparent full agreement with Ben Shapiro, but, quote, no, Donald Trump cannot accept a $400 million flying palace from the royal family of Qatar. Not only is this farcically corrupt, he said, it is blatantly unconstitutional. So when we first discussed this story, as it was breaking on Monday, I noted that while I'm not a lawyer, as far as I could tell, Bondi was actually kind of right, at least about the bribery piece of this, and that piece only, because, as she claimed, Trump was supposedly not giving anything to Qatar in return for this gift. It therefore failed to meet the ridiculously high bar that the U.S. Supreme Court in recent years has set for violations of the nation's bribery statutes. But that there appears to be no way, as I see it, of getting around the plain meaning, the plain text and clear intent of the Foreign Emoluments Clause of the U.S. Constitution. Now, how that would be adjudicated, given that the last time Trump was in office and an emoluments lawsuit was brought against him for foreign money flowing in through his Washington, D.C. hotel, which, by the way, he sold just after leaving office, didn't need that anymore. Well, that case took so long to make it to the Supreme Court that he was already out of office and the case was dropped as moot. Though should it have been? I would argue that what we are seeing today argues very much to the contrary. But again, I am not a lawyer, much less a public corruption lawyer, though I do know someone who is and who just happened to write about this very thing today in his Substack newsletter. Our friend Randall D. Eliason, the former chief of the fraud and public corruption section at the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia, who now teaches white-collar criminal law at George Washington University Law School and contributes to many prestigious outlets and, as well, writes at his own site, sidebarsblog.com. Randall Eliason joins us again now. Welcome back, counselor, to the broadcast.
Thank you. Glad to be back. So you're not a lawyer, but you play one on the radio. Pretty solid analysis, I think.
Well, good. Thank you. Glad to hear it. That's what I was going to ask, because it sounds like, even though I'm not an attorney, when I read your piece, I said, okay, sounds like we kind of both agree on this question of bribery. Is this bribery? Is this a violation of the emoluments clause or both? We'll get to the emoluments clause in a second. But it seems that since you too felt that thanks to these what I would call ridiculous rulings in recent years by the U.S. Supreme Court, that this cannot be seen as a case of bribery. Is that correct? And if so, why? Why not?
Yep. So far as we know, anyway, because as you said, the Supreme Court over the last couple of decades has narrowed public corruption laws so much that there's a strict requirement now of a link to a particular official act that you can identify and say this gift was because Trump agreed to do this in exchange. And it's not enough just to say we're just trying to cozy up to him. We're trying to give him all these, no matter how expensive it is, they could give him $400 million in cash in his own bank account. That's not a federal bribe anymore, unless they can link it to something he agreed to do in exchange. So it walks like bribery. It smells like bribery. When you say it's not bribery on social media, everybody gets mad at you and says you must be an idiot.
Right.
But fact is, which happened to me today. But the fact is, the way the Supreme Court has interpreted bribery, so it should be a bribe, but right, it's not. Unless there was some agreement we don't know about by Trump to do something in particular in exchange. If it's just a cozy up to him, curry favor with him in general, because they're hoping for future things to happen, that's not a bribe.
Which is, I know, I understand it, you understand it, but even as you explain it, it just seems absolutely insane. In other words, you can give anything you want to a public official, and it's not just Donald Trump. It's any members of Congress, a governor, etc. You can give them a gift of anything you want as long as they don't say, hey, in return, I'm going to give you this.
It is absurd, and I've been writing about this for years. But, you know, that's the Supreme Court's concept of corruption, is that these statutes are limited to strict quid pro quo corruption. So buying access, buying influence. As corrupt as most of us believe that is, and as corrupting that is in fact to the political system, it doesn't run afoul of federal bribery laws, according to the Supreme Court. Now, Congress could have stepped in to amend those laws, but, you know, they haven't done that for some surprising reason.
So this is not a constitutional issue. This is actually a legislative issue that Congress could fix if they wanted to.
Yes.
Because there are all kinds of things, it seems to me, that even if they didn't say, hey, give me that plane and I'll give you this, there are all kinds of things that Trump could in the future give to Qatar, that, you know, things they want over the next 4 years, whether it's explicitly agreed to in advance or not. Isn't that just common sense in a situation like this?
Absolutely. And that's why I say in my piece today, you know, there's no question this is corrupt, as most of us understand the term, because what you're doing is giving him this incredibly valuable gift in the hope and expectation that sometime down the road, he'll do something nice for you in exchange, because he's going to remember how good you were to him. And that's the kind of thing that motivates the bribery laws and the Constitution's prohibition on emoluments, is this concern that public officials are going to act not in the public interest, but in response to some private benefit that they're getting. So it runs afoul of all of the principles underlying bribery law. It's just that the way those laws are currently interpreted, it's not going to fit in as a criminal bribery violation. Now, that doesn't mean it's not wrong, and it doesn't mean it's not corrupt. It just means if you tried to prosecute the case, you'd probably lose.
Now, you say that Congress could change the bribery laws. Could the Supreme Court change their interpretation of the current bribery laws if Congress does not act?
Well, theoretically, yes, they could reverse their earlier opinions. Certainly not with this court likely to happen. I mean, and a lot of those opinions, frankly, have been unanimous or close to unanimous. It's not just the conservatives. The court as a whole has taken this very narrow view of these corruption statutes. And so it really would require, I think, congressional action to step in and make it clear. No, we think, you know, this kind of gift with the, you know, hope of currying favor with this public official, that should be prohibited.
The emoluments clause, on the other hand, of the U.S. Constitution, that seems to be clearly a different matter. The president supposedly is still required to follow the Constitution. Is his violation of the Foreign Emoluments Clause here as clear as I argued that it was in my introduction, as you see it?
I think it's pretty clear. Apparently, Bondi and you know, other supporters are arguing, well, this is okay because they're actually not giving the plane to Trump. They're giving the plane to the Air Force and then later to the library. So because these other entities are going to actually hold title, it's not really a gift to Trump. And if you look at the language of the emoluments clause, I mean, you could make that argument, say it only prohibits it if you give the gift directly to the official. But that's really artificial. I mean, you know, suppose you buy a house and put it in a trust or something, or in the name of a corporation, and let me live there for free.
Right.
Is that not a gift to me just because someone else owns title? Mm-hmm. And that's basically what we have here, right? They're buying the plane. It's clearly intended to benefit Trump. He's the one who's going to benefit from having this tricked out Air Force One. So the idea that this is not any emolument or gift to Trump just based on who actually holds title to the physical aircraft is pretty lame. Plus, he's commander in chief of the Air Force. So if the Air Force owns it, he's in control of how it gets used, right?
Right. Would it have made a difference in that argument had it been, okay, it's not going to the presidential library at the end, that it's going to stay with the Department of Defense, that it actually is an actual gift to the Department of Defense that Donald Trump will get to use in his, you know, next 3.5, whatever, years of office. But then after that, we keep it and we continue to use it.
Yeah, I think that would certainly help, because then you could say not only is it really a gift to the nation, not to Trump personally, but we could stop spending the billions that they're spending on the two new Air Force Ones that they're currently trying to retrofit that are way behind, that Trump is so mad about. The crazy thing about this deal is, you know, he says it's such a great deal for the U.S. because we're getting this free plane, but we're really not, because they're still going to have to go on building the two new Air Force Ones, because this one's going to leave office when he does.
So, right. Yeah. It doesn't save us anything.
It doesn't save us a dime. It just gives him a nice fancy airplane to ride around in, if they could even get it ready in time, you know, which, again, there are all kinds of logistical issues with this as well, right?
Yes.
A lot of people are suggesting even if the gift goes through, it takes so long to get it up, get it retrofitted to actually properly serve as Air Force One that he'll already be out of office by that point.
It's ridiculous. It's stupid. It's corrupt from top to bottom. But I'm trying to figure out, A, what can be done about it and, you know, how, whatever can be done about it, how it might affect all of the other corruption we are seeing from Donald Trump and, yes, from future presidents. After Trump left office the first time, Randall, the Supreme Court dropped an emoluments lawsuit against him that was brought by good government groups and advocates, as I recall. That claim that he was accepting gifts from foreign governments via stays, money that was given to his Washington, D.C. hotel, all of which, by the way, seems kind of quaint now, in one sense, given the tens and hundreds of millions of dollars that are apparently being shoveled into his family's cyber coin operation. But that case regarding
nickel
the money,
nickel and dime stuff, that was nickel and dime stuff.
Yeah, apparently. But yeah, it was originally, that case was dropped, as I recall, as moot because it was no longer in office. But clearly, Randall, it wasn't moot. I mean, shouldn't that or couldn't that have been continued anyway, given that it was obviously a constitutional issue that would apply not just to Trump, but to any president, be it Joe Biden, a second Trump term, or any president in the future? Should this be adjudicated by the Supreme Court once and for all?
Yeah, I think that's a decent argument. I mean, there is this doctrine capable of repetition but evading review, I think they call it, where they'll take a case even if it, strictly speaking, is moot, because in this case it was, because Trump had left office, so it's, there's no longer a gift to the president issue, but because he's not in a position to act, you know, on their behalf anymore. But if you consider the fact that how long it takes for these suits to get through the courts, you could make an argument that the court should decide this just for future guidance, like you're suggesting. Mm-hmm. Even if this particular case might be moot, we should go ahead and decide it so that in the future courts and others have guidance on what this actually means. So,
right.
Yeah, I think they could have. I think there's just not much appetite in the current court for taking on these issues, you know, related to Trump, that if they don't absolutely have to. And so they just thought it was more convenient to get rid of it. And I probably, nobody thought he was coming back at the time, right?
Well,
so, yeah.
And in this case, will this be another case where someone, and I'm not even sure who has the standing to sue to block an apparent violation of the emoluments clause, but who would have the standing? Who would be considered harmed by it if they did take this plane? I guess it has to be somebody who is literally harmed by it as the standard for determining who has standing to sue.
Yeah, I'm not sure. That's a real difficult legal question with the Emoluments Clause in general. I mean, in the first Trump term, there was another lawsuit brought by some members of Congress, and that one got tossed out based on the argument that they didn't have standing because they weren't actually injured. And I'm not sure who would have standing here. Theoretically, I guess, depending on the facts, maybe Boeing or some contractor to Boeing, if they could make a showing that their work on the other planes is now being affected. Or they lost contracts because he's now going to use this plane. And so the other work, I mean, I'm just making stuff up.
Well,
but, you know, if there were facts like that, then maybe. But other than that, I don't know.
Well, let me make something up, Randall. Aren't we all being deprived of a public service, a legitimate public service, when the president is doing these things that are clearly unconstitutional?
Yes, but that's usually not enough to give standing in federal court. I mean, if that were the case, then any taxpayer at any time who felt aggrieved by some particular action could run into court and try to sue the executive branch. You know, you need some particularized injury to you that sets you apart from kind of the citizens in general.
Well, anybody could run in, but they'd have to make the case that there was a constitutional violation here.
Sure, but you know, if that gives you standing, then anybody can file a lawsuit. Anybody can file a lawsuit, right? You might not ultimately prevail, but to be entitled to pursue the lawsuit, you need some more personalized injury, and not just a generalized taxpayer grievance. But the, you know, I think the bigger picture, the bigger point is we can't rely on lawsuits to solve this problem, right? I mean, it's going to take too long and get bogged down again. If there's going to be a response, it needs to be a political one. You know, it needs to be enough people standing up and objecting and putting pressure on him that he cancels the deal. And I think there's a reasonable likelihood that actually happens. They end up not doing this, and he'll back down from it because he's going to get so much heat. But I think that's the response, and ultimately the voters have to respond, right? If they don't like this kind of corruption, then we have to vote these people out of office.
Yeah,
you can't rely on lawsuits to save us in something like this.
I certainly can't imagine this thing is actually going to happen. It's just this case. It's just too ridiculous, apparently for many Republicans. But it still seems to open the question of what it's going to take to get to court, to the Supreme Court, to have them confirm that the Constitution says what the Constitution says. Because at the same time, we've got all of this other corruption by the American president that we're sort of watching play out before our very eyes. His family's, you know, crypto scams, et cetera. His tour of the Middle East in countries that are doing business right now with his family.
Yeah.
I mean, is, again, the only solution just a political solution, just public opprobrium, writing about it, folks like you, and speaking about it and then acting on it at the ballot box? Is that all we got left?
I mean, it's staggering what's, I don't know if accepted is the right word, but just almost, I don't know, shrugged off these days, right? It's become so... The corruption's become so pervasive and on such a large scale. I mean, I wouldn't say there's never a role for the courts if you can find, you know, particular individuals that are harmed by particular actions or actual, you know, provable bribery allegations and things like that. But I do think in general, and this is how I kind of concluded my piece today, so much of kind of good government and ethics and the rule of law, they depend on norms and traditions and things that people have kind of voluntarily abided by for the most part while in office for generations, but they're not necessarily written down in enforceable statutes. You know, it depends on people of goodwill being in public office and recognizing that it's a public trust and behaving accordingly. And with this administration, that is just out the window. And what we learned a lot during the first Trump administration is just how many things like that do depend on these kind of just norms and standards that when you get right down to it, it's hard to find a way to try to run into court and make them force them to do it, because we always just kind of accepted that, of course, people will behave this way when they're entrusted with public office. And you don't need to put everything into, you know, criminal statutes, right?
No, we apparently, we do.
And now we're seeing what happens when you have someone in office who doesn't care about any of that.
Yeah. I mean, it really does seem like we do have to put it that if we learn anything from this chapter of American history, it seems like nothing should be left to mere norms and traditions, and that we actually need some major rewrites of our public corruption laws.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, that's kind of a bleak picture of the future. Then we no longer have honorable people in public service. We just have litigation. You know, I mean, I prefer to think we could maybe get back to a time when you had. It wasn't that long ago, you know, and not that it was perfect. And of course, there were people who abused their power and things like that. But in general, just people in public service who believed in these kinds of norms and abided by them voluntarily, because that's the right thing to do. And that's what you do when you're serving the public. I'd rather get back to that than to a situation where we have to double the size of the statute books and run to court every time somebody does something.
I would rather get back to that too, Randall. But that doesn't, I don't know that we have that option at this point. Speaking of bleak pictures, before I let you go, a couple of other related matters I want to quickly run by you here. The last couple of times that I believe that we talked to you on this show, I think one case was just before the start of Trump's second term and then a few weeks into it. That you said you were sort of eyeballing, if I remember very closely, what was being done at DOJ. and that while you were troubled by the offers to, you know, staffers and prosecutors to sort of take voluntary retirement, to leave if they wished, now would be a good time, you know, they had said, but that you would really be concerned if you saw top prosecutors being actually pushed out by the administration. It kind of seems like we have crossed that Rubicon in spades by now since the last time we spoke, Randall. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, it's what's happening at Justice is terrible, and it's heartbreaking and kind of violates everything DOJ has stood for decades. And like you said, they're pushing people out for doing nothing more than doing their jobs. Or those people are leaving because they can't honorably stay there and do what they're being asked to do. That's one of the things that troubles me the most about all of this is what's happening at DOJ. And one of the things I worry most about the long-term damage that's being done to that institution. So it's a real problem.
And I should note also at the top of the DOJ, you've got Attorney General Pam Bondi. She's the one who, you know, apparently signed off on all of this plain fiasco. But right before becoming Attorney General, as I understand it, she was literally on the Qatari payroll as a paid lobbyist for them, receiving $114,000 a month for that job. And then she came in and said, no, it's fine. Let Qatar give this plane to the president. Are there no rules or laws that would actually require her to recuse from such a decision, given her paid ties to Qatar?
That's another one of those norms again. No, I don't think there is an actual law. Recusal is generally a matter of discretion, right? And again, people with acting in good faith with some common sense would recognize that situation where obviously she can't be involved in this decision. She needs to step aside. You know, and as recently as the first Trump administration, we had people like Jeff Sessions, you know, recognizing he needed to recuse himself from the Russia investigation. I mean, and that was a voluntary decision, but he did the right thing, even though I didn't agree with very many of his policies as Attorney General. Mm-hmm. But there were still some guide rails in place and people in office who still adhered to those kinds of norms. And the really worrying thing about Trump too is that none of those people are there. He's made sure he's just surrounded by people who are just going to do what he wants and back him up. And that's pretty scary.
I suspect that you've been looking at what's going on specifically at your own old DOJ office, the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C., with some amazement as it's been run for the past several months by Trump's acting U.S. Attorney for D.C., this guy named Ed Martin, a Republican activist. He's not even a prosecutor. He represented January 6 defendants. He, you know, interviewed neo-Nazis on his podcast and then, oops, forgot to tell the Senate about that. Before his confirmation hearings, it seems like he can't even get enough Republican support in the U.S. Senate for confirmation to do the job permanently. Well, now he's being replaced by Fox News host and former Westchester, New York district attorney, I believe, Jeanine Pirro. Do you have any thoughts on all of that, Randall?
Oh, yes. <It's>... Yeah, I don't know. It's
that was your old office, right?
Yeah, it's my old office, and like I said, it's just heartbreaking to watch. I mean, Martin had no business being anywhere near a U.S. Attorney's office. He's a political hack, no prosecutorial experience. Immediately started doing things that showed he has no concept of what the job involves, including, you know, demoting or firing the January 6th prosecutors. And, you know, he wrote to Georgetown Law School and said his office wouldn't hire any more of their graduates until they changed their DEI policies.
Right.
He was writing to scientific journals asking for evidence that they, you know, consider points of view from both sides. And I mean, just stuff that has nothing to do with his job, completely inappropriate. You know, Pirro, you know, I mean, I guess a main qualification for a job in this administration is having been on Fox. But I mean, at least she's a former prosecutor. I mean, you know, as crazy as I think that appointment is, it's a step up from Martin.
Yeah.
In terms of background and experience, but it's just, it's a sign that they're, it's just a deeply unserious administration.
Yeah.
You know, and they don't care about the policies these people are going to implement or who they're putting in this office or whether they're qualified. They're only, their chief qualification is unquestioned loyalty to President Trump.
What would you have done had you still been there during all of this? Because I know you, I believe you served under various administrations, right? Of Republicans and Democrats alike. And I'm sure you thought about what would you have done had you been there for this chapter? Would you have stayed and tried to make the best of it, or would you have you know, run for the hills and resigned perhaps as loudly as possible rather than be a party to such madness? How would you have proceeded if you were one of those prosecutors that are, well, now being pushed out in droves?
Yeah, I mean, that's very hard to answer in the abstract. I think it's a very personal decision, because you can argue you should stay and try to make things better from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And that if all the good people leave, then no one's going to be left but the Trump sycophants, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so you should stay and try to quietly resist. But you also have to live with yourself and live with your conscience and live with your own ethics. And, you know, it's one thing if you can kind of lurk, depending on your cases and what you're doing, if you can kind of lurk in the background and keep trying to do your job and stay kind of below the radar and try to do the best you can, that's one thing. But then if they come to you and ask you in a particular case to do something in particular, you know, then that you can't do, that's unethical or inappropriate, I mean, then you've got to resign, you know, as we've seen a number of people doing.
Yeah.
So part of it depends on whether it really comes to a head in your particular case. I mean, it's a big office. There are a lot of prosecutors there, right? Do you get asked to do something personally that you personally can't do? Or can you kind of, like I said, stay in the background, stay up below the radar and do try to do the job well still, even in that current environment, and mitigate whatever damage is taking place? So I think it's very individual, going to depend on the individual circumstances. You know.
Last question for you. Can Humpty Dumpty be put back together again? I hear, you know, a lot of federal officials saying they fear, they're saddened about what they see going on at their you know, where they served for so many years. But then there's a concern that it can never be repaired. I kind of look at that and think, well, look, anything that's broken can ultimately be repaired if you remove the folks who broke it. What's your feeling looking forward when we get through this chapter? Will we be able to restore the DOJ to what it once was?
It'd be a long, hard, slow process, right? You've got to rebuild that public trust. And that means you have to have people in office that believe in that and they're willing to do that work. I mean, we kind of did it after Watergate, you know, there was a great breakdown in trust in the presidency and the justice system after Watergate. And we kind of slowly built that back. Mm. And, you know, maybe that, I hope that can be done again. But everybody, you know, and it's not just about this issue, but everybody is just so cynical about everything these days. And and no one knows what to believe because they see, you know, all this fake news on social media and aren't sure what's true and what isn't. And I don't know, it's a scary time. And but one of my biggest concerns is that it's not only heartbreaking to watch what's happening, but, you know, the concern is, can we ever get it back? Can we fix it? And, you know, I'm not so pessimistic that I'm convinced that it can't be fixed, but I do think it's going to be a real challenge for the future.
Well, that's why it's so important, frankly, that folks like you are still speaking up with your Sidebars blog, coming on this show, explaining what is actually going wrong, confirming folks like me who say this doesn't seem right. Yeah, you're right, Brad. It is not right. I think the public needs to understand that before we can ultimately, hopefully, begin to fix this mess and maybe put Humpty Dumpty back together again. We will see. Thank you so much. Randall D. Eliason, you can and should follow him on the Blue Skies at R.D. Eliason. You should sign up for his Substack newsletter at sidebarsblog.com. He is the former chief of the Fraud and Public Corruption section at the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia, now teaching white-collar criminal law at George Washington University Law School. Randall, always a delight speaking with you, sir. Thank you so much. We'll talk soon.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You bet.
Bye.
Well, you know, Desi Doyen, we started with good news about elections, good news about the courts, and here we are with a grim close. You never know what you're going to get on the roller coaster that is the broadcast. Best to just, you know, sit back and try to enjoy the ride, I guess.
Well, I don't know what to say. One way of looking at it. I am interested in Randall's assessment of how difficult it might be to rebuild. I mean, how do you rebuild the Justice Department? And what I hope is that we will get a chance to try and to find out.
Unfortunately, it's not just the Justice Department this time around. It is like every department in the federal government that Donald Trump is just absolutely crushing. So
yes,
the story is going to be, I fear, the same across the federal government. And we're going to have to see a period of rebuilding.
I hope so.
Reconciliation. I don't know what we're going to see, but it's going to be a big effort. And we're what? Just over 100 days in.
Yeah.
See, I told you, started out with good news, and now everybody wants to jump off a cliff. Don't do it. Don't do it.
All stay right. Around for the rebuilding.
Yeah, stay around. We're going to need you. All right, got to get out. Thanks again to Randall Eliason of George Washington University. Thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, and the biggest thanks of all to you for joining us for a portion of your day or night. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other that we've ever done since the beginning of time, they're all available for free, no paywall, at bradblog.com. Hey, thanks to those of you who consider hitting the donate button at bradblog.com or going straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves so we can be here for the rebuilding. If it ever comes. Thank you for that support. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, you will find me at The Brad Blog. See you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.